Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, Surviving the 21st Century, a look at health and nutrition in our modern world. Joining me in this quest for knowledge are my good friends, the research and writing team of Manny Barling and Ashley Brooks. Hello to both of you.
Hello and good morning to everybody.
Good morning.
So, how has your week been?
Oh, hectic, like all Americans. The weather's up and down. When we're complaining about weather in Los Angeles, you know, it's bad. So.
Oh, we had a rainstorm last night that was torrential.
I know, compared to Mississippi, it's nothing.
I mean that famous song, It Never Rains in California.
Oh, someone was joking.
Albert, it was written by Albert Hammond. Do you know who Albert Hammond is? The songwriter, he wrote it, Never Rained in Southern California. And one day, Ash and I will tell you some of our favorite Albert Hammond stories. One time we represented in our hedge fund, and terrific human being. His son is now the lead singer in a major rock group. I've forgotten its name, but he moved here, and he was the first summer he moved to Los Angeles. He was living in Britain as a songwriter. It rained the whole summer, and that's what prompted the song.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I love these little pieces of trivia that you just seem to have an abundance of.
Well, Ashley, do you think Simon will enjoy the Albert Hammond story?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Trust me, you're going to love this, but it's not fit for the radio.
No.
Okay. Well,
you have a story for us, don't you?
I will bear that in mind. Oh, I don't know if you watch the news at all, but the big news this week was IBM's new computer, deftly named Watson, won a Jeopardy challenge. Did you follow that one?
I watched a little bit of it. Usually I'm a big Jeopardy fan, but I was so busy this week I didn't have time to enjoy it or not enjoy it, which as the case may be.
Well, of course, the question I have is, you know, Watson obviously has made a bit of a name for himself. I mean, he trounced the two previous largest winning Jeopardy folks. I mean, what's next for him? I mean, do you see him on Let's Make a Deal or Wheel of Fortune?
The Queen for a Day, the old TV show. You know, one of my complaints, and I've been following Jeopardy since I was a young man and actually a decent Jeopardy player, and I find that they control victory sometimes by picking exactly the areas of questions they want to ask. I thought that was true of Jennings, who I thought was treated and babied for a long time and given a lot of easy questions to keep him on the show because the ratings went up so high. And I thought to some extent Watson, the kind of areas and ways they pick questions favored Watson a great deal. But he still won, and that's the way it goes.
Well, of course, the burning question I have is, are we going to see Watson on Celebrity Squares? Now, you know, of course there's going to be the need for a little reprogramming. Those IBM engineers are going to have to preload Watson with a bunch of lame jokes. But
well, you know, he could take Paul Lynde's famous square. Can you imagine Watson doing an impersonation of Paul Lynde, the late comedian?
Right. Okay.
The real question here is exactly what we see in every sci-fi movie. How far do we want to go with this? Everybody talks about all of its great contributions to the human race, but I've yet to see any contribution from any of these programs. I think all too often the contribution is more chaos. Because I don't care who you are, you cannot create a computer without some error factor. And that error factor, as you process billions of bits of information, starts increasing dramatically. So, and I know you've been in the computer industry most of your career, Simon, if not all of it. I think you'll agree that every computer you've ever seen will spit out a certain amount of errors, and the consequences of those errors frequently can't be foreseen.
Right. I mean, I look back at the Pentium Pro chip that turned out to not be very good at math. I mean... Excuse me.
My kind of chip. Did I do the program? I did that program.
And on a slightly a slightly more fruity note, I also remember an early version of Microsoft Word that had a bit of an issue with the spell check. If you typed in the word Pentium, it would flag it and suggest that probably the word you were looking for was penis.
Oh, no! Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
I thought that was a rather classic one.
Yeah, I've been to the other one, of course, spell checks aren't as good on your internet source, because most of them use Microsoft, which doesn't have the best spell check in the world. And you come up with the weirdest things, and I can't think any now, but I have a variety of friends of mine whose names, when you hit spell check, will give you the kinds of options that would get you triple X. I mean, it's really strange how it comes up with issues. By the way, I don't know if you read any articles on Watson and some of the tests they ran for Jeopardy before the show ran, but it would come up with some of the strangest answers you've ever seen. So, and I think the other night what it did is it duplicated someone else's answer too, didn't it?
Watson is not a thinking beast. It's a knowledge engine. It has to have the basic facts. All it does is sift.
Well, that's true with most computers. It's a Boolean search. It's trying to match up a variety of different words that combine to put together a source of information, and that's not uncommon. But at the end of the day, much like Google searching something, you may end up finding some bizarre subject in China, which is fun, but it's not okay if you're trying to solve a medical problem or a variety of other things. So at some point, when you look at an area, like I'll give you an example, Los Angeles, USC's teaching facility at County General Hospital this week mistakenly put in a wrong kidney in somebody. Luckily, that person matched the kidney enough for it not to reject it, but they had to close the program down for a while to make sure the, quote, efficacy of the system was okay. In other words, they didn't want to kill anybody. Well, the thought of a computer making that decision about such things as who's going to get this particular organ transplant or controlling the distribution of those items scares me.
Oh, indeed. And on the subject of Google searches bringing up, bizarre results, where do you want to start this week?
Well, let's talk about one that bothers everybody. It's a stink over medical testing. We have a problem right now in the United States where everything is just basically released, and everybody goes, oh, my goodness, it's approved by the FDA. It's wonderful. It's been tested. Well, the reality is testing has gone out the window. You know, a number of months ago we had Daniel Dantini on, a researcher, a doctor who's written a wonderful book on fibromyalgia, and every time that I talk to him, he points this out. 30 years ago, all of the medical testing was done by the National Institute of Health and was basically looked at very carefully. It was paid to independent researchers, and basically we got independent reports. Well, along came some Republican administrations, and they decided that wasn't the best way to do it. They should send this to industry, and they started providing these massive grants to industry to do testing and allowed manufacturers to test their own products. So recently there's a series of articles and about this problem, and one of them involves Dr. John Ioannidis, who's probably the foremost expert in assessing the credibility of medical search. And here's the foremost authority in the world on how medical research goes. He says, quote, up to 90% of published medical information directly relied on by doctors to determine treatment is misleading, exaggerated, or quite often flat wrong. Even more unsettling, the medical community agrees with this assessment. You know, Simon, I've pointed out for a long time how all of my doctor clients either got their information about drugs and things in the hallway from really cute-looking, drug company sales girls, because believe me, the drug companies now are as close to pandering as I've ever seen. They find these young girls right out of college, send them in the doctor's office to distract doctors and sell products. And what they don't get there, they go away to these seminars. Oh, where's the doctor this week? Oh, he's at a seminar in surgery. Well, the reality is that seminar is in Maui, Hawaii, or in Bermuda somewhere, and he's basically laying on the beach sipping on a pina colada or something else instead of going to class. And he goes to class. The class is sponsored by the drug company who's teaching him to prescribe their own drugs.
So or a procedure or whatever it is that they're passing out.
Some are going to do like lap band and all the rest. So at the end of the day, doctors are limited to what they learn from manufacturers and drug companies, and basically the research they rely on is one that spoon-fed them. And this research is done by companies who submit it to the FDA. For example, when the genetically modified foods were approved, all they were approved on were some short tests by Monsanto. Oh, well, if Monsanto says their product's okay, it must be okay. But I think as an average citizen, we're not willing to accept it. It's almost like someone coming to you with a used car and saying, oh, it's perfect. It belonged to a little old lady in Pasadena. Oh, that dent in the fender, don't worry about it. Well, that's how they treat the products they're selling today. Oh, a few people die from it, don't worry about it. And I think that's a big problem. And I know, Simon, you've been looking at this for a while. What's your reaction to these articles?
Well, they bother me greatly. And in fact, as does the TV campaigns I see for drug products. In the small print, you know, side effects include death.
Right. Or your leg falls off.
And the worst part, worst part to me right now is that the warnings, when they've changed a lot of the warnings that basically say, you know, if you take this drug and you know about the side effects and something happens to you, in so many words it said, legally Manny would know the wording, it's your fault. It's your fault if you die.
Yeah.
It's your fault if you get a heart attack. I mean, basically they're now shouldering the responsibility of what's happening on the people.
Well, Simon, you may recall in some of our books, we actually took the ads on television and we did a transcript and put them in the book. And when they're going by at Mach 1 in the middle of a TV commercial, it's hard to grasp. When, as you saw, particularly, I think it was Celebrex, it was another one in the book, you read it and you go, oh my goodness, and you read it again. And when the average person has a chance to read it two or three times leisurely, I think you're appalled, right?
Oh, absolutely. Essentially, it boils down to don't take this if you're sick.
Right. And to go even farther, people go, oh, it can't be that bad. Well, the same doctor in the studies that they published said the paper showed both theoretical and empirically that 80% of non-randomized studies, which are the ones that are the most common ones, actually, and 25% of the gold standard randomized studies and nearly 10% of the platinum standard large randomized trials were incorrectly executed.
This means that that's the way in which they do the testing.
Well, let me explain what they are, okay? What they call the gold standard, the randomized test, means that basically they divide two categories, 100 people on one side, 100 on the other. One gets a placebo, one doesn't get a placebo. So nobody really knows what they're taking, okay? Well, the real question is how do you execute them? And how they execute them is cheating. First of all, they'll take a product, when we cite these in the book, and they give somebody a similar product to see if they're allergic. And if they're allergic, then, of course, they won't fit into the group. So they sort of qualify the applicants for the group that are going to test their product to make sure they have the highest quality applicant. And on the other side, they don't care. And so they can also control it by the category. In other words, they can look at your medical history and get some indication whether you're going to be good in the test or not. So if you're going to cull out the best possible choices, that's rigging a test. It's even, you can even call it salting the test. So the 10%, which they talk about platinum standard, which is the large randomized trials, where you go from maybe 50 or 100 people to several hundred people or even 1,000 people, well, those are even harder to control, and there's more room for dishonesty. Now, if they were being conducted by an independent scientist, you'd go, okay, he'll make some mistakes, you know, or it won't be perfect. But when the industry, who has a vested interest in that test coming out in their favor, is given control of the hen house, the fox starts organizing the chickens in each direction, guess what? The test is going to come out exactly the way the fox in the hen house wants. So what he's observing and what everyone basically agrees in the industry is you can't trust these tests. Now, I'm going to pass this to both of you. I've asked my doctor and several other former doctor clients about this, and they agree completely that they scoff at a lot of these tests. Sometimes when I see them, I take them to my doctor and go, what do you think about this? And we have a 10-minute laugh about how corporate America is manipulating numbers. But no matter how much doctors laugh about it, they're still prescribing these drugs, and they're still following the tests. And I know you had an instance with Jan where you were upset about the way they handled potassium and a variety of different pills, and I think you found that happened there too. No information, nothing, right?
Right. In some ways, that there needs to be a patient's bill of rights. I mean, I'm not one for, you know, yet more legislation. I think we have legislation aplenty. But most patients are just run roughshod over. How possibly can a doctor diagnose a problem and come up with a long-term solution in a 10-minute discussion? I don't see it. I'm sorry. You know, not even IBM's Watson could do that. And incidentally, that's what they're going to be having him doing next. And I'm serious on that.
A number of years ago, a movie was released called Doc Hollywood with Michael Fox. It was a cute story about this doctor who wanted, I think he wanted to be a plastic surgeon or orthopod, and he's driving across the country and gets stuck in a small town, and he has to fill in for a doc. And it compared the local doctor who walked up and down the street, saw his patients every day, measured their walk, measured the color of their skin, saw what they ate, and was able to make these basic decisions about his patients based upon the total look at their entire life, okay? As opposed to doctors who spend the 10 minutes. I'm blessed. I represented my doctor for 35 years. He's a very close friend of mine. I saw a lot of him. He would look at me some days and say, you know, I don't like the color of your skin. I want you to have a blood test. And I would go, I don't need a blood test. And he'd look at me and go, you need a blood test. But now people see for 10 minutes. So in our books, we discuss what you do to get over that. And Ashley, maybe you should talk about how we try to teach people to create questions and to walk into the doctor prepared with a list of their symptoms. You want to add something about that?
Absolutely. One of the most important things is is the fact that you need to take a notebook. And if you have a doctor's appointment, before going into that doctor's appointment, you should be charting every day how you feel. Do you eat breakfast and you fall over after you eat breakfast? And write down what it was. If you have your medicine and after you have your medicine you get dizzy, or 2 hours later this happens or that happens or your pulse changes, you should check your pulse. You should check your skin. You should check your temperature. Check your own blood pressure. It's easy to get a machine, very easy to get an automatic machine that will check both pulse and blood pressure. So you can check it twice a day and write it down for your doctor.
You can buy one as cheaply as $29 in Costco, electronic stores, or even your local drugstore, which usually drugstores are higher. And I wanted to add one quick thought to that. I thought after my cancer surgery and I was stricken terribly with Crohn's disease and other ailments, I could barely walk. I was in a wheelchair. And one day I was having difficulty with my disability insurance company. You know, nobody likes to pay lawyers money for being disabled. Nobody wants to pay anybody in this country. Even if you're half dead, they try to find a reason not to. And Ashley said to me, you know, honey, you need to do like a medical chart and start charting all of your health things. So I got up one day, and every day I charted my blood pressure, and I wrote down my symptoms. You know, I was ill, too many trips to the bathroom, had this problem,
Describe fully every time you go to the bathroom, were you putting out a lot of urine?
Yeah.
What the amount of your stool was? What color was your stool? Because that tells the doctor how your kidneys, your liver, your functioning of your gallbladder, how the color of that stool says a lot of how your body's functioning. So he started writing this down.
So, Simon, you notice I didn't go there. So basically, one day I walked into my doctor's office with 4 or 5 pages the entire month from the first to the end of the month, and I saw him the following month, and he looked at me and goes, wow, this is really interesting. And he spent 10 minutes in front of me reading it and going through it. Wow, your blood pressure. And he started explaining to me how all of our blood pressure goes up around sunset, 4 or 5 till 6 in the evening. And he said, look, this is what you ought to do. You ought to take your blood pressure first thing in the morning to see what it's like when you get out of bed. And you can put it on your breakfast table and do it while you're eating, you know, and take it somewhere between the 4 o'clock and the end of your work day to see the difference. So I basically started doing that and created another chart. And he got so interested in my chart, he started making suggestions. So if you do that, your doctor will too. Then he told me a few things that he wanted on the chart that would help him. And together we sort of created a little chart that helped him improve the quality of my health. That was the turning point. And somewhere in looking at these over a few months, he looked at me and said, and I was complaining to him, you know, you can't complain to your doctor, but I can. I would say to him, you know what you're talking about. You're going to too many of these drug company seminars. And in his case, he's a professor at a major university and is paid to give them. And I said, you guys need some independent information. And he said to me, none of us have time. He said, they've changed medicine. We're seeing 40 patients a day. We're not getting paid. We're having this problem. We have multiple meetings. So on. And he ran off the whole litany of why doctors are struggling right now. He said, look, you know, you got time. Go research your health. Go on the Internet. Read books. You'll learn more than doctors have time to learn. And the light went on, and I went home and got the next thing. Learn about yourself, yeah. So if you're getting migraine headaches, you need to sit down and read every book, and not WebMD and all the classic ones. Go to the people who don't agree to them. Read what people say. Read what's in chat rooms. You know, listen to other people have your illness. If you got together with 20 people like they do at AA or some other meeting and attended a meeting just with people who have had whatever illness or malady you've had for the last 5 or 6 years, you will learn more than you will ever learn in a doctor's office. And that's the problem with testing right now. Don't you agree, Anna?
I do agree with that. And the main thing with having your own notebook that has you all about you is like keeping a daily diary. And as a kid, women all kept diaries. I don't know anybody who didn't have a diary book when we were kids. We had a lock and key because it was so important. But you know what? The most important, seriously, Simon, you had a lock and key. You don't want anybody to ever read it. Well, the most private things about yourself, you can write into this notebook, and it goes to the doctor. Now, doctors are used to every single day going to the hospital looking at a chart. looking at somebody's notes, because that's how they evaluate what they're going to do that day and that decision about how to treat that patient, based on a 24-hour somebody else's notes on that person. Now, my gosh, if you yourself were making those notes, you would catch things, because what happens? Nurse walks in the door, hey, how you feeling? I'm fine. That's what we all say. I'm fine. I'm doing just great. Hey, thanks.
Yeah.
But the truth is, you may not be fine. There may be things that you miss throughout the day that if you start taking your own notes, changes will occur.
And I'll give you an observation. I'd come out one in the morning. I'd be limping. I'd be, you know, I probably looked horrible. And Ashley would say to me, how you feeling? I go, I'm doing okay. She goes, yeah? You look in the mirror today? She goes, look at the way you're walking. Your foot's swollen. And she'd start rattling off these
things. I go, what about the rash on your forehead? How about that red thing? When did that start? And we'd start on one end of his body and work our way through his entire body.
And, you know, and it's amazing what you ignore. I'd be getting this rash for a while that I realized was an allergy to his particular medicine, and I was blaming it on, oh, gosh, maybe I'm getting the age or I'm getting skin outbreaks. But so things that you may think are minor in your body or changes like that are really very important. And the importance of it, I want to point out by coming back to our topic with this bad research.
Before you do that, there's a question that I really, really want to ask. And I think, Ashley, you might be the best qualified. Manny mentioned this idea about blood pressure, you know, and that round about sunset it rises. In layman's terms, why does that happen?
You know, I really don't know.
Well,
it's part of the body.
I can answer that for you, because I asked that question not only my own doctor to a few others, and I got some varied answers, because there's no specific material written on it, and my doctor told me that most doctors don't even notice it. And what happens is it's, one, the effect of your lunch. Two, people might have a snack after lunch, so if they've had a high carb or a high chemical lunch with a lot of GMOs, McDonald's is a great example. If you go supersize at McDonald's and maybe sneak a candy bar in, and you go check your blood pressure at 5 o'clock, you're not going to have great blood pressure. Conversely, if you're a salad eater and you starve yourself to dinner, then chances are the changes in your metabolism late in the day will also increase your blood pressure. And I can speak as a lawyer. Sometimes I would get 30, 40 phone calls after lunch,
yes.
A lot of them threatening, crazy. People who work are like a snowball. You get in the morning, you go to work, you're a little tired, business a little slow, everybody jumps in, the snowball's going down the hill. By 11, it's building up speed. By 2 or 3 in the afternoon, the pressure of finishing your day, the pressure of phone calls, the pressure of being ready for tomorrow.
Pressure making dinner, pressure of the kids, pressure of...
So towards sunset, the average American goes through a transition of wrapping up work, trying to ramp down to go home to their family, deal with shopping, Little League, coaching, all those things that go on. Every American on the phone listening to us right now on a podcast goes through it. No wonder everybody's blood pressure goes up at close to sunset around that time. So some of it is chemical, and some of it is the chemicals caused by the stress and the other things in your body. I'm sure the Dalai Lama has as good a blood pressure at 4 in the afternoon as it does at 10. But, of course, he's never worked a day in his life. So anyone listening to the show who works for a living understands the difference between their body at 8 o'clock in the morning and at sunset in the evening. And that's pretty much the answer, Simon.
And, Simon, going along with what Manny was just saying, a lot of what, just based on what he just said, a lot of what people, they want to put a science on it, they want to put, you know, this has to be founded by whatever, it's common sense. What he just said is common sense when you really think about it and you put that material together, so that data, when you're looking at it, you don't have to freak out because something's changing. Use common sense when you're looking at those notes.
Mm-hmm. And I want to come back for a moment. There's two issues I want to come back to. The first one is to look at the study we're talking about and the doctor's impressions of how bad research is. It wasn't some random thing. they focused on the 49 most highly regarded and cited research papers published in the last 13 years. So they didn't pick the bottom end of the spectrum to check. They picked the best, most respected, and important studies, and of those, 41% had later been disproved when tested, and 24% hadn't even been retested. So 40% of what's supposed to be the best research in our country is bad and is disproved. That number is unacceptable to
all. Wait. But 24%, they never bothered to retest.
Right. So
which needed to be retested, which is a huge number disproved testing.
So the number could rise to 65%. So that means that there's a 6 out of 10 chance of medicine you're taking has either been disproved, is not good, or has a problem.
And because this information gets out there, scientists will then continue to quote it even when it's disproved because, hey, who wants to advertise this? It's no longer any good. So the scientists are still holding on to the old information because they don't get the new information. 12 years later, they're still saying that they're still quoting the discredited information because it's not put out there.
So we're raising this point for a reason, Simon. Every night you turn on the nightly news or you turn on Oprah, you turn someone else and go, oh, look what research has found, and they rattle off some statistics. We hope our listeners are suspicious of them. You've got to be. And if you read that study, as Ash and I go to those studies and we read them, sometimes we fall over laughing because when you look at the parameters of the study, they're basically dishonest.
I don't fall over laughing. I get angry. I get really upset because it means someone's going to be harmed.
Yeah.
Studies are vital studies.
And I'm going to end it with this. If we as lawyers, doctors, and the average person listening to this show mistreated the information they used bad research, ignored the truth, and basically tried to skate by on this, we'd all be put out of business or prosecuted. But the medical business, these drug companies and food companies are so large, they get away with murder, to use an expression. And I use that expression here because guess what? People die from these drugs. More than 100,000 people died of Vioxx, which wasn't tested because the test was fraudulent. So at the end of the day, I consider a lot of these companies murderers. If you know you're putting out a drug that's not tested and it's killing people, I don't know how people go to sleep at night.
Well, I mean, the guy from Vioxx
is
in jail right now for 10 years.
But, you know, they always say about, you know, criminal lawyers, you know, if people die from your malpractice.
All lawyers are criminal.
Well, absolutely. That's why I don't do it anymore. But seriously, you know, when you look at it, and the same thing with doctors, people die from the malpractice. Well, people die from the malpractice and actual intentional misconduct of food and drug manufacturers. And I want to come back to your statement that you're not for more, you know, laws and more controls and all the rest of it, and neither am I. I'd just like to see the ones on the books enforced. I think, you know, when you start pursuing a doctor for fraudulent tests like Vioxx and give him 10 years in jail, he should get the death penalty.
He was responsible for 100,000 deaths.
You know, he's a mass
testing
murderer.
There were no patients that were ever tested. He lied about all the Vicar tests.
Yeah, he should be on the TV show Criminal Minds. I mean, this guy's killed more than, you know, 8 years on that show. They haven't had the total amount of the serial killers haven't killed as much as Scott Rubens did with Vioxx.
And not one single pharmaceutical company person of the corporations went to jail with them. Oh, we knew nothing about it. What, you never looked at any of the patients or the Vicar test? What kind of testing is that? You never look or examine those patients with the doctor?
Well, there are a lot of emails that indicated they had some idea they knew. I don't think any rational American believes that a major corporation doesn't know when its employees are fooling around. And to make a long story short about it, it's not just them. It's the FDA, it's the USDA. You look at these recalls. We talk about the 550 million eggs recall. We talk about salmonella and Taco Bell. We talk about problems in all these various places, the E. coli in the beef, et cetera. Why are these happening? Because of shoddy testing, shoddy controls by the government. Every one of them could have been stopped if we had a vigilant FDA and a vigilant USDA. How about the salmonella outbreak with Peanut Brother? I guess it's 2 years ago now. They couldn't even get to the source. They started blaming spinach from Mexico, and it turned out it was done in the peanut butter plants, and they weren't even inspected. And when they looked at them, they were so disgustingly dirty and vile that you wonder how they got away with it for years. Wright County Eggs of Iowa, which was the company, and Hillendale were the two companies that put out all the bad eggs. They hadn't been inspected in years. The owners, the DeCosta family, are the major contributors to the Attorney General of Iowa and former Governor Vilsack, who's now the Secretary of the USDA. So, I mean, when you look at this, Americans aren't protected. So we need to look at every ad, every test, every study, and decide for ourselves where our government is just loud big business to do whatever they want, because if not, you can't protect yourself.
And our goal with this show has been to help educate people, and that's our continuing to help educate people. It's not to go off on FDA and all these other companies. It is to make an awareness so that you're aware that when you're looking at tests that go, hey, the FDA approved this, stop, wait, really look at the tests and see if they actually were tested.
So, Simon, let's talk about an example of that. You did an article, I think, recently on silicone breast implants, right?
No.
Well, it's been a while.
Actually, it wasn't breast implants. But it was a deadly, serious story. A young lady decided that her buttocks were not as round as they could be, and got a friend to inject silicone into her.
Oh my god!
And it was a deadly mistake. The silicone actually hit some blood vessels. It flowed into her lungs, where it solidified as silicone will. She's dead. Number one, it was a stupid thing for the young lady to have got involved in. But I mean, the whole use of silicone is something that bothers me. I mean, there's lots of great humor about silicone breast implants. In 2006, there was a lady in Romania who was in a what probably would normally have been a deadly car crash, but her impacts or her implants rather acted as airbags. I'm serious. I mean, I couldn't make this stuff up.
I wonder if her breasts had a warning on them.
there was another case, and I think it was 2008, but I might have the year wrong. And it happened in your neck of the woods. A lady survived a gunshot wound
right,
due to her size D implant. These are all highly humorous, but the fact is, the body doesn't really like having foreign stuff in it. And what has me concerned right at the moment is this whole nonsense that's going on about lap bands.
Before we move to lap bands, let's finish a comment about that. I had a doctor client who I haven't spoken to much in this year or in the last year, who at one time had seen as many as 3,000 women in Thailand. I believe the number was over 5,000 in India, and a total of about 25 women who had had reactions to silicone and breast implants. And he was an expert witness, and he was just one of many expert witnesses. And he estimated the number of women who had difficulty with breast implants were part of all these various lawsuits, were over a million women. And some of the problems is it bleeds. I knew a lady who had a variety of surgeries because the silicone started to escape and have lumps on her body. Ash and I know someone, a very well-known actress, was married to an Academy Award winner, who it just destroyed her life. It got into her face. She started getting lumps. And it traveled.
And then they try to cut it out. So they had to cut into her face to remove the silicone, because once it gets into your body, it travels all over, and it causes autoimmune problems, and it causes lupus, and it causes scleroderma. I mean, there's just silicone is people need to stop and look up silicone to see this, where this plastic is used.
Well, more than that, so what chemicals are used to make it.
Oh, horrible.
But the problem is it deteriorates in the human body, and at the same time, it's something we discussed throughout all of our books. Anything you put in your body, whether it's genetically modified food, certain pills, Vioxx is an example, are things that your body rejects. So what does your body do? It gets this little signal in the brain that there's some foreign object in the body, and much like any country, your body's like a country, it sends troops to attack it. Well, what are these troops? They're a variety of different chemicals and other things to protect the body. So that, in turn, leads to inflammation. So now you have a foreign object in your body being attacked by various chemicals in your body, and if it happens in your kidney gets inflamed. If it happens in your pancreas, it gets inflamed. It can cause diabetes, for example. It's one of the things we think causes weight gain, but anything that's plastic, like, you know, your child swallows a plastic toy, you go, oh, my God, what's going to happen to him?
It's in the emergency room.
Right. But yet people put plastic into their bodies and go, oh, well, it doesn't really matter. And the Tida lap band is actually, through a variety of research, found that the same silicone used to make breast implants are used to make the lap band, Simon. So if the lap bands bother you, then the first thing that should bother every listener who's considering one or even reading some of these ads are, that it's a kind of plastic that deteriorates. So if you put a plastic toy out in your yard and watch the effect of rain, sun, and everything else, and watch how that plastic deteriorates, imagine it in your body being hit with everything from acids to other things and even chemicals. What if a person takes a fair amount of certain chemicals in their body, 6, 7, 8, 9 different prescriptions? Those chemicals in the prescription will affect the plastic. So you put something in your body that by very definition is going to deteriorate over time. So as it deteriorates, where do the deteriorated chemicals go? Into your bloodstream, into your brain, and into your organs. And that's the first kickoff period about not only lap bands, but also the silicone. So you want to jump into lap bands.
Well,
go for it.
What bothered me most about lap bands, Simon, was the fact that, again, lap band, the silicone for the lap band has still not been tested. There's no testing done. They just went, oh, silicone, okay, it's approved over for your breast, so okay, fine, we'll just use it in the stomach. It has never been tested.
Yeah,
okay,
and
before you get into the technical stuff, why don't you explain exactly what 1-800-GET-THIN is all about?
Well, let's come to that in a moment. Let's first throw some numbers out. More than 150,000 lap band surgeries were done in 2008. And one of the reasons this is coming up now is people have probably seen a number of discussions on television where the leading manufacturer of gastric bands, which is basically Allergan, have received permission to expand the market and to sell this to a number of different people who are now eligible. So if the allergen lap bands for patients are approved the way they have for milder forms of obesity, then the existing target market group could add up to another 27 million Americans as potential customers.
My question, and maybe I didn't phrase it very well, what is a lap band?
It's a surgical device that is silicone, and they do surgery, which implants, and they implant it around the stomach, and it's to make the stomach area smaller so that you suppress the appetite of the, they're supposed to be for the extremely overweight. But then they keep decreasing the numbers so that more and more people will have lap bands, because it's not about person's health. It's about how much that profit can go to Allergan.
Well, let me throw in the numbers. Before, you had to be morbidly obese, which is defined as more than 100 pounds overweight. If the FDA, and it requires a full FDA approval, approves the current standard being offered, it would drop that to 50 pounds overweight and would prefer that you have some kind of additional ailment, like diabetes, for example. But it isn't going to be mandatory. So, you know, it's sort of like dropping blood sugar from 150 to 100. Every time you drop some test group by 10, 20 pounds or 10, 20 points on cholesterol or 10, 20 points on sugar, you're expanding the marketplace to 5 to 10 million more Americans who you can potentially sell to. So every time you look at these tests, ask yourself, is this, you know, the manufacturer looking for more customers, or is this a legitimate test that shows this is a problem? Weigh that against what we've said, that 80% of the tests are inaccurate, wrong, etc., then you have to suspect whether the numbers you're being given are really true. So here we have Allergan, who's just salivating at selling more lap bands, getting the FDA to approve it for people only 50 pounds overweight, hoping that, well, maybe only 1 out of 10 people of the additional 27 will have the surgery, but that's 2.7 million people. That's a huge amount of people, a huge amount of money.
I'm sorry, Simon, go ahead.
So essentially, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around the concept.
Okay.
It's basically putting a rubber band around your tummy.
Right.
No, I've got a better description. You know, the new plastic things that people, the police use for handcuffs and use them on a lot of containers.
That's a great description.
You know, where you slide it through and you lock it in place. You know what I'm talking about, Simon? Tie locks. I couldn't think of the name. Thank you. So that's what it sounds like to me. They stick it around there and they keep drawing it and tightening it to whatever area they want. And if they over-tighten, it's very dangerous, requires a second surgery. And if it's too loose, of course, it's not effective. And so I would describe it more like that. So here you have this plastic band just sitting there being attacked by every kind of acid in the world. And by the way, this is made worse by the fact that Allergan's an aggressive marketer of lap bands, and they just really want to sell them, which brings up your 1-800-GET-THIN. On one side, they go, oh, we don't think everybody should do it, but on the other side, they're doing nothing to stop all these doctors. In Los Angeles, they have this billboard that drives Ashy and I crazy. It's 1-800-GET-THIN. and it's sponsored as if, oh, the lap band's the answer to your question. And, you know, Allergan goes, oh, well, we can't control what doctors say. Well, but they don't want to stop them either. So at some point, the L.A. County Department of Health asked the FDA to investigate because it couldn't get them to remove it. They said, you don't have any authority to stop it. It's not illegal.
And they're misleading promotions that are going after the vulnerable people.
Right. So basically, when they tried to stop it, the billboard sponsors and, of course, the manufacturers filed a lawsuit to try and, you know, protect everybody. So there's now a big fight over who can say the latest fat product. So don't be surprised if you don't get everybody from Jenny Craig and the rest of them coming out in opposition to it, because it affects their market. So now Americans are becoming guinea pigs on fat drugs. So as obesity increases in America, which is what our book It's Not Your Fault is about, basically, we've got, the Food Anonymous group, the people who think you can do it as behavioral sciences. The behavioral scientists like Dr. Phil who argue, oh, it's all in your head. And then you've got, you know, the lap band people saying, oh, do use our device, we'll make you thinner. And, of course, then you got all the trainers, you got, you know, Bally's advertising. And come January, there are more ads for weight loss after everybody parties at Christmas than there are for some other drugs. So Americans who are obese now have become a profit center, like a gold mine in a mountain, and American corporations are trying to mine the gold, which in this case is fat, out of them, and dollars.
Okay.
So along with that comes the inherent dishonesty when you've got a whole marketplace trying to take money from you.
So I think since we started this program, Simon, about how, you know, how these devices and things are not really truly tested, I think it's important to understand that when the FDA, when Allergan proposed to the FDA getting this done and getting this on the market, there was supposed to be a 5-year study, and it involved 149 patients, and they said it's safe and it's effective, let's put it on the market. Then when they went back to study it, it turned out that the FDA included only the first year, so only 1 year of testing. The original 149 people, 6 dropped out in 24 months. At least 4 of them had their bands removed. And then as they continued to study this, they found that as time has gone on, they have found out it's less effective. It's more hazardous to a person's health the longer it remains implanted because, again, you have silicone and autoimmune response problems. The body's going to try to fight against it. And after several years, these patients regain weight and more complications occur because you've altered, even if you remove it, you still altered part of your body. So
Simon, are you dying to recommend them to everybody you know?
Oh, I can't wait. I mean, as soon as I wrap up today's program, yeah, I'm going to be dialing 1-800-GET-THIN.
Well, you know, one of the things that disturbs me is that with all the ads, and you know, they should have warnings and telling people, you know, it can get worse. And I think it's, I don't know where I read this. I thought it was like 1 out of 5 patients have to have a second surgery.
That's correct.
Plus, in addition to that, sometimes the band actually becomes part of the stomach. Now, I don't know if that person's going to lose part of that stomach because I can't find anything where a surgeon will actually say, we had to cut away the stomach.
And by the way, 1 out of 5 patients also have to have them removed because they can't stay in for health reasons. And by the way, while we're switching on to another subject, Allergan is the same company that turned out Botox. They sell
right.
$1.3 billion a year in Botox. It accounts for 1/3 of their net sales. So this is a company that's purveying plastic parts to be installed in Americans that are, if you look at the sum total of death, injury, illnesses caused by Botox, lap bands, and all the rest of it, this company is causing a huge problem in our country in terms of life and death. And I heard an interesting statistic that's comparable. People rail against guns. And I heard Michael Bloomberg the other day, the mayor of New York, talking about how since Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy's death, more than 400,000 Americans have died from guns. Okay, 400,000, we're killing 34 people a day. Well, if you look at the medical breakdown and go to some of these Internet sites that give you statistics on health, the deaths from plastic parts and other things and people that people ingest and a variety of other devices are not far over off a gunshot deaths. But nobody's campaigning to get rid of these things that are killing Americans, but they're concerned about guns. So Americans find various ways to kill each other and various ways to die. And certainly plastic parts in your body have become a very, very important one. And I'm going to end with this thought. If you have a broken leg and they put a pin in, it's stainless steel. If you need a rod in your leg because of an unusual break or arm, it's not uncommon, it's stainless steel. And when you take a look at what's done in those type of surgical devices, even heart monitors, et cetera, it's high-quality material. But here we are with a human gut or Botox or in the face or you know, silicone in the breast, and we're using the worst, cheapest, degradable material that money can buy. Of course, stainless steel breasts wouldn't be very functional either. But, and that's, by comparison, what's so very dangerous about this.
And Lapion is not a miracle cure, and as we talk about in It's Not Your Fault, it, first of all, if you get a Lapion and you're grossly obese and it's going to take you a year to 5 years to lose it while you have to have one or two or three or 4 hour surgeries, which are dangerous every time you have a surgery. Your abilities of having blood clots and heart attacks, and there's a lot of danger, infections, there's a lot of problems with it. Why not take the slow, you're going to have to take a slow route anyway. And once you get the Lapion in, if you're still eating the same foods you were eating and you've not educated yourself, even if you're going to get that Lapion, you better educate yourself on food and understand what you're putting in your body so you don't continue the same functions that made you gain weight and keep the weight on.
And the last thought, it's also who does it. A lot of these clinics are, a lot of people have these done in clinics that don't have hospitals. Kanye West's mother died of a liposuction done by a neighborhood doctor who should have been doing it in the hospital. So if you go into one of these places to have this kind of surgeries, any of these surgeries, and there's a problem, then you really need to be in a hospital. So if you're going to have this surgery, if you are over 100 pounds and you feel this is your only choice in life, it's important that you research the doctors, make sure you have a hospital available, that you're being done in the best possible circumstances, because it's dangerous. Last night I watched an Academy Award-winning film on Louis Pasteur from 1937, and it dawned on me watching how Pasteur went through 20 years of trying to convince people to wash their hands before surgery, to wash the instruments, and this whole journey of his to find the vaccines for anthrax and rabies, that in some respects we have the same problem now. And it's not about being hygiene in the hospital. It's about neighborhood clinics who don't have the quality of equipment nor the backup in case of emergency performing these kind of surgeries, saying, oh, it's okay, it's just a Lapion, we'll get it done in a few hours. And so the death rate is going up. 2 years ago, I think it was, maybe it was three, eight people died of Lapion surgery in Florida alone. These numbers are just despicable. So if for any reason you know anyone or a member of your family or you're dealing with this issue, please understand there's two aspects, whether or not this is right for you and how you get it done, because how it gets done could either cause you a lifetime of misery and additional surgeries, or it can kill you.
But Manny, by doing the program that we have with the enzyme formula and working out the diet to figure out what caused you to gain weight, like you could not metabolize the food, and we found out that food was so toxic with the CAFOs and the factory farms and the GMO. Once we discovered that, you dropped 80 pounds over the course of a year, and you've kept it, or 90, you're at 90 now. And it took you 1 year, and if you had a Lapion, you would have been threatened to, you could have died in surgery, you could have gone through more problems with autoimmune response, because your immunity was already down, and your metabolism couldn't break it down, your food, so therefore, you did it with the diet.
So, Simon, shameless promotion. If you're in this class where you think you need a Lapion, please read our book, It's Not Your Fault, about weight gain, obesity, and food addiction, because we can save your life and help you avoid a surgery if you just read this book and just follow even half of what's in the book. So let's go on to what I consider
right.
The next
and I want to do the segue, shall we say.
I'm
still really, really hot under the collar about all things GMO. In fact, I was sat outside earlier today thinking, which is never a good thing.
Oh, I'm scared. I'm shaking.
Right. You know, I started to, look back at the last 100 years or so, and I come to the conclusion that GMOs in some ways are like lead paint and maybe even asbestos.
I agree.
For years, they were the norm. But lead paint, asbestos, are now banned or at least very highly regulated. They're downright dangerous. But it seems to me that GMOs, that there aren't any long-term studies done on them, that there doesn't appear to be any hard scientific evidence. I mean, I know that there are researchers that would love to, get their hands on some, wonderful Monsanto Roundup Ready seeds, but of course, no way will a company like Monsanto give agreement to an independent study. I'm annoyed. I'm hot.
Good, because I think every American should be, because it is a problem. I mean, let's talk about some of the latest news and most current stuff about Monsanto. And we go to Monsanto because Monsanto holds over 14,000 patents on genetically modified foods, intellectual property patents. So here we have the largest manufacturer, the primary mover. The other one is what do you expect? DuPont. I mean, why? How can you not have a chemical problem without DuPont in this world? The manufacturers of napalm.
And
by
Teflon.
The way,
Teflon that they knew back in the 50s, Teflon would cause cancer.
Yes, and by the way, when it comes to the topic of asbestos, I don't know if you know this, but the British government had discovered the dangers of asbestos back in, I think it was 1902, and started banning asbestos in England long before it was banned anywhere else. So asbestos should not have been the biggest surprise in the world either. So we have this long history of people knowing the dangers of things, but yet really doing nothing about it. So anyway, looking at all of this, let's cover some of the more recent topics. We do talk a lot about Monsanto and the problems they're causing, and partly because many people like Corporate Watch consider them the foremost corporate criminal in the world, which is not a compliment. You know, we've talked about super weeds. I understand after talking to Dr. Tickey and looking at some of the things that he had sent me, that the super weeds are actually getting worse. Arkansas, Missouri, southern Missouri, and those areas are getting weeds that look like the old movie Day of the Triffids. You remember Day of the Triffids, I'm sure, right, Simon?
I do.
And, when you start reaching a point where things start looking like Day of the Triffids, I think you have a problem. And Day of the Triffids, I always laughed, was a low-budget movie where basically there were plants that looked, I would describe, something like giant asparagus running loose and taking over the world. So we have a situation where, you know, the old story about life imitates art. Well, lately, or art imitates life, excuse me, is going on, because what's happening is all these things that all these sci-fi writers from Rod Serling on down the line said were going to happen actually are starting to happen. And that is scary right now. So here we have the use of Monsanto's Roundup Ready herbicide all over that area, and instead of killing bugs, it's creating super weeds. And we actually have more weed problems and more things going on in that area now than we've ever had before. For example, I'm sure people know what Roundup is. Roundup is that favorite herbicide you can buy in the store that kills damn near everything, including people. It's something the U.S. government used to try to wipe out the cocaine fields in Central America and Colombia, that it basically killed millions of people there and destroyed their crops and destroyed their life. So we already have seen its devastating effects on flora. Much like you wouldn't use napalm in the United States, I don't know why we're using Roundup herbicides. So basically, they were introduced in 1996. Monsanto claimed that the herbicide use would drop as a result of it, because it is a gentler herbicide than some of the others, but it didn't. After 3 years, and starting for that period over to the next 10 years, the amount of herbicides used increased almost, I think it grew tenfold. So it jumped to a whopping 383 million pounds in the 13 years.
And that's because Roundup herbicide loses their value after a few years, and they're effective for only a few years, and the weeds and other plants become resistant. And it also affects the soil that they're grown in as well.
Well, you know, and basically, as we're discussing, what do you think happens? Exactly what happens in the movies. The plants lick it up, go, oh, I think I like this, and maybe I'll just transition into something else, like, oh, something more dangerous. So basically what we have is we are creating a new type of weed never before seen in this world that is now starting to take over two states in the United States, as well as creating huge plant problems. They drenched more than 130 million acres of Roundup in the central part of the United States where we grow food. That's a huge amount of soil that's endangered.
And that pesticide and that Roundup Ready is going into the conventional crops, because they're now using a new word, new fancy word for the GM things growing in your, that you're buying at your grocery store, is conventionally grown. That means it is Roundup Ready, and it's filled with pesticides down to the DNA of that fruit and vegetable or what you're eating.
Yeah, so, and I'll give you a quote out of, a partial quote out of a book we recently read on some of this. Over time, many types of weeds that would once keel over with just a tiny dose of Roundup now require heavier and heavier applications. Some are nearly invincible. Those are the superweeds. In reality, these superweeds are resistant not to the glucophyte, which is the basic ingredient Roundup, but to the soil-borne pathogens that normally do the killing in Roundup sprayed fields. So what they're saying is the Roundup destroys all of nature's natural ways of protecting the soil. So here we are adding something that we've been told was going to save the world. It's not only not going to save the world, it's endangering the world.
In fact, in January 13th, 2011, the World Watch Institute that recognizes that the fight against hunger and climate change will not be won using the industrial agriculture. They had 400 scientists approved by 60 countries, in which the World Watch, which, again, independent research organization based in D.C., works on energy, resource, and environmental issues. They claim, this is Emma Hockridge, head of the policy of the Soil Association, said, this agroecological farming system, such as organic, to achieve food security for all, organic farming systems benefit biodiversity, are resilient in the face of climate change, and have been shown to improve yields and the ability of poor communities in the global south to feed themselves. In other words, they're saying we need to go back to organic, and organic is the way that we have to feed the world because this other system is not working. So I thought that was interesting from World Watch.
So, Simon, I know you have some feelings about it. You're somewhat new to this. Unlike me, you nearly didn't die from these foods. You didn't go through some of the horrific pain that I went through caused by these foods. Because I can tell listeners, if I eat genetically modified foods tomorrow, I will be in bed for several days, sick as a dog.
And it happens. If you're out and about, you get that rash and you're sick.
Yeah. And
okay, but the question I have is a more global one, if you will. Why is it that we in the U.S. Are basically being force-fed GMO material, and yet the EU and various other parts of the globe are going nix on Monsanto?
I think it's 1-800 Think Thin. It's advertising. It is, you know, hey, we're out here, we're on all your foods, so therefore it's okay. And it's a lack of labeling, because when they actually do research on people and they ask, do you want GMO, 98% of the people will not. There's only actually 5%, I take that back, 95% of the people say no, they don't want GMO. So they just don't label it.
Well, I just go a step farther. It's the classic you know, absolute power corrupts. What we have is a system in which, in the United States, manufacturers like Monsanto are able to manipulate the system by simply making political contributions. Simon, you published a blog recently about how twisted the FDA is with appointees from the industry. Well, if you're going to put foxes in the hen house, you're going to have problems. Basically, in Europe, they don't allow this. And, of course, Monsanto's not a European corporation. It's an American corporation. If they were a European corporation based in Europe with all that kind of political power, they might be able to coerce Europe into it.
And so they sue people. How about the lawsuit in Germany?
Let's just sue
the whole country.
They do. They have. I think the last time I read it was like they spend $10 million year. Well, I think that's low for them. But that's, I read where it was $10 million a year just suing farmers alone. You know, so they sue anybody who just says anything against them or doesn't agree with them.
Tell us about the lawsuit in Germany. And this got lost in the news, and one of the reasons we're bringing it up is because with all the events going on in Egypt, basically it allowed them, as in Monsanto, to keep this from becoming a major piece of world news, because they've been fighting a battle in Europe to try to have their products approved. And what kind of battle is it? Well, read WikiLeaks. I went to WikiLeaks, and I actually read the documents that were published that everybody's screaming about. And I've got news for you. They are really disturbing. In Spain, the U.S. government helped Monsanto to try to intimidate the country into using GMO products and Monsanto's BT corn. There are actual strategies that you can find in WikiLeaks where the United States has participated with Monsanto in a policy and an attempt to try and compel countries to use their products. I don't think our country should be doing that, especially trying to impose, you know, this type of activity on a foreign nation. They wonder why foreign nations are angry with us and don't trust us. Well, this is a very, very good reason for them to feel that way.
That's right, because they're out there saying, basically, to me, Manny, and this is what really bothers me, they're out there saying, we're Monsanto, we're United States. They represent us in these other countries. We're looking bad because the people in these other countries have run scientific data, and they've run it independently because they're allowed to in their countries, unlike America. And they run these tests, and we'll get into those tests later if we have time on this show. If not, we'll bring them in next week. That absolutely, unequivocally show you the damage of what the GMO foods do to people, including obesity. So one of the things you asked me, Manny, was about the lawsuit. Monsanto is so mad that Germany will not allow their grain, their corn in. So Frankfurt, they went to Frankfurt and they said, we're just going to sue you, April 2009. So fortunately, Monsanto lost because the Germans cannot be intimidated. So in November 2010, the court had ruled that the farmer who grows GM plants will continue to be liable for any economical loss caused by GMO-contaminated conventional crops. And they upheld the county's federal constitutional court rights that they would not allow Monsanto to bully them into having the GMO. So they lost to Monsanto, which I thought was a good thing. And then again, this was not noticed in any of our newspapers. It showed up, Francis Tickey was kind enough to send this out and post it. The Germans had a protest after a scandal from dioxin contaminated food. And in that, on January 22nd, they had 22,000 people, again, 22,000 people that came out and chanted, "We have had enough." And they marched and demanded that agricultural policy protect them, and that was at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see how other countries are dealing, but yet Americans aren't doing anything because basically that information's been withheld from them.
Right, and I think this goes back to, you know, what what you said earlier, it's the fox guarding the hen house. I mean, you know, I had for many years considered the FDA and USDA as being, you know, bastions of keeping us all healthy. But they seem to be little more than a rubber stamp for whatever the industry wants to do. I mean,
right.
That's
well,
not
how
right.
about the USDA just got caught? Manny, what was that you were telling me about? They just got caught in Mexico bribing?
Well, it wasn't Mexico. Of course, the most famous one is Monsanto got caught bribing the Indonesian government and were fined by the FCC and the other ones because there's actually an act that you really cannot, I forget the name of the act, all this one slipped my mind, that basically prevents corporate bribing. So they basically spent a huge amount of money in Indonesia to bribe officials to approve the GMO cotton and got caught.
It's called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which means we in the United States, being represented by Monsanto, are violating Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, against their act. Now, how good do we Americans look in Indonesia when we're caught? Monsanto, we're supporting, we're Americans, and there they are actually bribing people.
Yeah, and, you know, they've tried to do it in Mexico, and, of course, as we point out in our book, you know, they tried to bribe Canada to approve their product RBGH, which is the bovine growth hormone, and the Canadian government officials have said on camera in an interview, no leaking, no beating around the bush. They went on camera and said that Monsanto tried to bribe them with offers of $1 to $2 million to gain Canadian approval for the RBGH. You know what Monsanto said? Oh, we were just offering to help, and they misinterpreted what we said. Gosh, that sounds like something you watch in a movie where someone tries to intimidate somebody, or the mafia or something. They go, oh, no, we just asked them how their mother was.
That's right. We were just trying to help.
Yeah, right. And one of the things they did, like in Indonesia, is they immediately tried to repeal the new law that they had, which was the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And when they couldn't, when they can't get the law changed, they bribe people.
Yeah.
And that's they've been caught over and over doing this, and this is what this company does, along with the fact that they lie. Like, they just got caught with the alfalfa contamination. They got caught lying about the statistics.
Well, remember sugar beets, Simon. Didn't you point out that despite having a court order stopping them from growing sugar beets, they got caught planting them anyway, and they had to destroy several million seedlings? Didn't you report on
right,
that?
Right, but as I understand it, the court order stipulated that the seedlings had to be destroyed, but Monsanto lawyers have kind of, excuse the pun, got a stay of execution on that one.
Right. And as a matter of fact, they went to the FDA, and the FDA helped them, and they're going to approve the experimental planting of it over a court order, which is going to raise a question of whether or not the Congress, and or in this case, I'm sorry, the executive branch, because the USDA and FDA are controlled by the executive branch and president, have the power to overrule something the court does, as opposed to people doing. And I can tell you from my studying of the constitutional law that if you're going to change a law, you have to change it either by vote or by the vote of the people, which require more than a 50% vote. So here the question is, can they pass a legislative rule that can change something the courts have ordered once the courts have already done it? But after all, Monsanto has the power and the money to ignore everything. So Let's talk about it, more of this. I mean, talk about bribes. We continually point out how Monsanto paid the Rowett Institute $230,000 to have a study done by Arpad Pashtai, one of the leading scientists in the world, that basically said what we say in our book, that if you eat GMO products and they're fed to animals, that leaves a bacteria in their stomach that causes illness and disease, as well as polluting plants and other crops that around them. Well, when he published that a few years ago, Monsanto went nuts. So they hired a PR group called the Bivens Group to put out false, phony emails that are condemning him and other things, and then got the Rhode Institute to redraw their study. So, of course, a newspaper in England, of course, caught them and published the bribe, and then 20 scientists around the world conducted the same study, all very famous scientists, noted scientists, and proved it was right. So this is the length that they will go to affect testing, which goes back to the start of the show. You can't rely on Monsanto's tests on their own products when there are dozens, in this case, I think there are over 70 tests condemning GMO foods. So who are you going to believe, the independent tests or corporate America who are doing this for greed? In fact, my view of GMO products has only been around for 20 years. So who are you going to trust, Mother Nature, who for millions of years have been putting plants on this earth and the last 10,000 years been feeding human beings, or some corporate company that has come up with some Frankenfood right out of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein to make money? Personally, I'd rather put my hands and my life in God and Mother Nature over a corporation. And that's the essence of what our argument is about it. And Simon, you may have your own views, which are less religious, but I'm interested in how you feel about it after reading all this stuff for 6 months.
Well, I want to comment on the whole scientific study aspect. I'm not a scientist. I'm a guy that writes articles. I hate to say this, but I don't think either you or Ashley are, quote, scientists. I mean,
no.
But what I notice is, we will put up some story. And it may be about, GMO in general. It might be about soy. It might be about, the horrible CAFO situation or high fructose corn syrup. And I sit and watch the comments come in. And pretty much I read them and I go, industry wonk. I mean, why do these people feel that they have to come out and attack us? I mean, I haven't received any $200,000 bribe.
They're getting paid to do this.
Well, keep writing. You might get one sooner than you think.
Yeah, they're just paid to do this. This is their job. What's sad to me is that we have such an amoral society that people are able to accept jobs, or are they so pathetic that they will accept a job that they know, or maybe they don't know, the fact that this person is capable of lying and they're going to protect them through their words. Words are powerful.
I'll retract my statement. I did actually receive a bribe, or an offer of a bribe, from Hunt's tomato ketchup. It sounded like they wanted to send me large box of samples if I'd just go away.
You know, Simon, one of the things that's really concerning me, and this one really, really, really concerns me. I'm going to give it as an example with pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceutical drugs are now generic, and every scientist, I've spoken to scientists, I've spoken to pharmaceutical people, I've looked at the books, and the thing that is completely clear is that generic doesn't have to have the same kind of testing and the same type of production, and that generic is completely not the same. And it's, I talked to a couple German pharmacists when I was in Germany, and now, right now, Monsanto's business is declining because their patents are expiring. So 60% of their Roundup Ready spray products are lost to cheaper generic brands. That means this dangerous thing that's already been put on the market is now going into the food sources without even, again, labeling or telling you this is a generic GMO, which is a degraded lesser. Now, what happened with the L-tryptophan, when they first started doing the research, Jeffrey Smith, I was watching one of his videos recently, and he was talking about the scientists that had turned over documents to him. And the L-tryptophan was genetically modified and changed, and because of the genetic modified generic brand, they had deaths. People were dying. So the L-tryptophan, with that particular brand that was generic, they pulled all the L-tryptophan off. Even if it was organic, they pulled, you can't buy it, it's off the market. And now the same, the standards are happening right now because you can't tell, you know, you ate this food, it was generic GMO, all of it within its generic GMO, you dropped dead from a heart attack from inflammation, and guess what?
And I'm gonna add this because we're getting close to the end of the show. There's a well-known doctor, Don Huber, who specializes in disease and is probably the foremost authority on glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And he says by weakening plants, it promotes disease. The glyphosate opens the door for lots of problems in the field. There are more than 40 diseases of crop plants. That's 40 diseases of crop plants. They're reported to increase with the use of Roundup, okay? And that number keeps growing as people recognize the association between Roundup and the diseases that go out. The USDA scientist, Robert Kremer, who's a rank-and-file scientist, not a politician, found a 500% increase in Fusarium root infection of Roundup-ready soybeans. In other words, Roundup is leading to a 500% increase in a root infection that affects soybeans. And these are just some of the other ones. And it spread over into Egypt, where Egyptian scientists found that GMO potatoes caused cancerous damage to the small intestines of rats. And they tried to stop that. And then in South Africa, Monsanto was ordered to remove false claims on the safety testing of GMO foods in South Africa because there are no GMO tests that support what they say. The tests they did conduct were proved to be inadequate and showed that it did cause cancer. And how do we know? Because Greenpeace successfully sued them in Germany, and the German government made them release tons of their own reports, and every one of them confirmed what we say in our book and what we say in the show. It causes illness in industry.
Well, next week, maybe we can cover the nutritional values of what's lost caused by the glyphosate and what's occurring within the plant set is nutritionally starving people, causing Alzheimer's, causing cancer, and a lot of other health issues.
So I want to wrap up the show, or our part of the show, and Simon, you can do the rest with this thought. Be careful what you eat. You know, that old expression about you are what you eat. Well, if you keep eating these foods, you'll be chemical dump sites. You'll be spending a huge amount of time in the doctor's office. You'll be dealing with weight gain, obesity, various illnesses from diabetes down the line, and even potentially diseases. And if you doubt what we're saying, just look at the youth of America, the weight problem, the number of childhood diseases, and ask yourself every time you see this on television, did any of this occur before we had genetically modified foods and all these chemicals in their food? And I end it with the same thing I say. When I was young, we all ate McDonald's. It was organic. None of us got fat. And nobody started getting fat on McDonald's and all the rest of these fast foods. And they started putting all these chemicals in their food and using factory farm beef. And never forget that a Big Mac has 56 ingredients and an order of fries has 46 ingredients. And there should not be 100 different ingredients and chemicals and other things on a simple Big Mac and fries. And
well,
if you wonder,
you know what? I like to cook, and I personally can't think of a dish that I make that has more than, let's say, half a dozen things in it. In fact, I'd be really hard. I'd be really hard pressed to find 20 different things in my cupboard.
Well, Simon, let me ask you this question. You've seen a hungry man dinner in the restaurant and in the supermarket. It's got 150 ingredients. I can't even think of 150 ingredients, let alone make something with 150 ingredients. Can you?
And two things on that. If you mark down spices, you remove from your thing how many, and they just put one little thing of spices on their label. So you're actually only using a few things.
So, Simon, if you can end the show with the answer to that question.
Oh, there is no simple answer. Absolutely none.
So on that note, I'd like to thank everybody for listening to us. I know they've heard some of this before, but hopefully they will think about what all of us are saying, because we'd like you all to be tuning in 10 years from now, listening to us as healthy as you can possibly be. Thank you, sir.
Right, and better still, 10 years from now, they'll be going, they were right. They were dead right.
One of the things, Simon, too, as I wanted to say, is that Organic Consumers Association is right now running a million signature for labeling. They will, some representative from the organization will be speaking next week, and to please go online, put your name on it, get a million signatures for proper labeling, because truth in labeling has to be done in order to guard and safeguard our health.
Do you have the website for them?
I will send it to you, and it's called organicconsumers.org. But I will send
or
a specific.
You can go to the Organic Consumers Association website, and they will have it also.
And I'll send a specific site to you, Simon, to log on with the post.
Great. And before I wrap this up, we've got to have that shameless commercial. Where can people find your books?
Well, they can find them on howtoeliminatepain.com, including 50 or 60 health articles that cover things we're saying today and things we haven't said. And, of course, they're always available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and a variety. I think it's 39 booksellers right now. And the books are It's Not Your Fault, Manny's Diet and Enzyme Formula, Arthritis, Inflammation, Gout, Crohn's, IBD, and IBS, and every one of them can improve your health and help you live longer.
It really is unfortunate that we're out of time, because I can't get on to my my absolute favorite subject, excrement. But you know, maybe we can deal with excrement next week, and what to do with it when the fields are frozen.
Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye, Simon. Thank you to the listeners.
Okay. Till next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a great weekend. Stay healthy. Have fun. And we will be back again next week. Till next time, this is Simon Barrett saying goodbye.